I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Starting from 30 years ago, they have seen all kind of roller coasters. So generally, they need to see something really impressive.
More from Marco Bigotti later as we discuss the future of roller coasters and, of course, their place in the United Kingdom's theme park scene. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson. And joining me this week, back from the dead, or a vacation or a holiday, whichever terminology you prefer, Mr. Ian Morris.
Hello. I don't think I had a holiday. I think I might have had some... You were on holiday, so I sort of had to take holiday.
Yes,
for at least one of those weeks.
Well, I'm very glad to have my regular co-host back. Later on, after we get through our small news section and our feature about roller coasters, we're also then going to have a bit of a mini rant, a little bit of a discussion about 3D cinema. And I would like to pose the question to Ian that it's a scam. But first, let's get on with the news. Music industry organizations, this is according to The Guardian, have won a high court battle over measures introduced by the government allowing people to lawfully copy CDs and other copyright material bought for their own private use. Now, this was a law that was enacted a couple of years ago that took many years to get into place, that basically said if you buy a CD lawfully and you make a copy for your transferring onto an iPod, let's say, then that should be legal. Because although you were technically making a copy, you were permitted by fair use, private use, you know, common sense, basically. Well, a judge has ruled that a government erred in law when it decided not to introduce a compensation scheme for songwriters, musicians, and other rights holders. Basically, the judge has now agreed that while maybe making this copy should be permitted, the rights holders should be compensated. This was a situation, I believe, with blank CDs when they came out, is that blank music CDs cost more to produce because there was almost a royalty scheme on the blank CDs that went towards the music industry to compensate for the loss of sales. Now, this is ridiculous in a sense because it's common sense to be allowed to make this law in the first place. Would you agree, Ian? And feel free not to, obviously.
No, I completely agree.
And the compensation scheme, what are they being compensated for? I'm just curious at this point, what is the compensation here for? Because they've made the purchase by buying the compact disc
thing. They're not being compensated for anything. This whole thing's stupid. I don't care. If they don't want me to rip CDs, well, I don't care. They can take people to court for it, can't they? Look how stupid they'll look. Oh, you bought a CD and then you wanted to put a copy of it on something that wasn't a disc. Well, then, you know, to jail with you, foul pirate.
I think it's going to be very difficult for them to enforce this. And this...
nigh on impossible.
And to whom is the compensation paid? And how? And how is it broken down? How are you tracking that a copy has been made? I mean, how does that even happen? It's not like the CD ripping tools are reporting back to an agency saying this has been permitted. So this has occurred. So what happens? Do we add more money onto the price of compact discs? Makes them even less appealing?
No. Here's what happens. Nothing. Nothing will happen. This is basically just lawyers keeping themselves busy and paid, whilst the music industry, for some reason, is prepared to finance that at a cost way beyond anything they'll ever get back in compensation for any of this stuff. They're just wasting their own money. They're doing, you know, they're saying, oh, piracy costs us hundreds of millions of pounds a year. Well, stop paying lawyers, then it wouldn't cost you anything, would it? Because you could just let it go. Because, you know, there's no point pirating music anymore, really, for the most part, is there? It's so easy to pay £10 a month.
Yes. I mean, I speak as somebody who still buys CDs, and I'm not going to go over reasons again why
it's okay to buy CDs. I don't have a problem with it. I just, you know, it's entirely up to people. But for people like me who, as a rule, don't buy CDs, my £10 a month subscription to Google Play is everything I need, pretty much.
Yes. So, I mean, this isn't just covering CDs, you should probably point out. I mean, this is covering all copies of digital material. So this includes putting ripping a DVD or a Blu-ray onto another device. If you want to rip your DVDs and put them onto a media center, this still accounts. This is saying if you rip a DVD, then the copyright holder or whoever benefits from these supposed payments deserve an additional payment to you because you have format shifted your digital content. It's a losing battle. And I think that, you know, to slightly play devil's advocate, I can understand that at the end of the day, if you're employed to be an undertaker, you shouldn't complain that you have to dig a lot of graves. And
no.
If you work at one of these music bodies and your job is to do everything in your power in order to protect what you're there to protect, then common sense be damned, you're going to have to do something because otherwise your job is at risk. And this is where it falls foul in my head as a devil's advocacy policy, is that it just feels like somebody is doing this so they can be seen to be doing it and therefore justify their own existence.
Yeah, quite.
Because I don't know who benefits from this. Like, I literally do not know. Absolutely no idea. I want to find a band in the street that thinks this is a good idea. Like, Taylor Swift this weekend, there was a blog on Tumblr, and I completely agree with her views about the Apple 3-month trial for its Apple Music service, the fact that they're not paying anybody for any song streamed during a 3-month trial period is affecting small up-and-coming artists for those 3 months far more than her, and, you know, she can make a stand for that. And I think, fair enough, I do think it's wrong to stream any content and not pay anybody for it. Somebody may benefit from that.
Well, not if they've agreed to it.
Well, no, but I wonder how many of them have been asked.
Well, the labels will have been asked. You've got to remember, Nate, that the labels are the problem. You know, the public wants to listen to music produced by musicians, and the musicians want the public to listen to their music because that's, you know, a lot of what being a musician is about. You know, you want people to hear what you're doing, right? Because it's artistic, and that's the point. But what happens in the middle, unfortunately, is a bunch of people in suits who get paid for doing pretty much nothing. And that's where the problem is. If we just got rid of all the labels and just dealt directly with the artists, I mean, I know that's not necessarily practical, although it becomes more
no.
so.
Now, the thing is, labels, I will stand up for labels to a certain extent because labels are a good thing. Labels make a lot of things happen. Like, there's also a huge difference between talking about the mega giant conglomerates of the world, if you want to, the major labels, and smaller indie labels. And a lot of major labels own a lot of smaller independent labels. And I don't even think that labels, by their definition of being a record label, is the problem. I think the problem is on a more microscopic level, which is that it generally only benefits the larger players in the battle. A lot of these arguments tend to be just around protecting larger bands or larger labels or larger pots of money. And I don't fundamentally think that if I was in power or if I was in charge in a label, I wouldn't be doing everything I could to try and keep as much money as possible, because at the end of the day, it's a disruptive industry. And if you're sailing in choppy seas, you really want to limit the amount of water you're taking on board. I think
you've made a mistake only in that you're right about the protection of revenue, but what the music industry has tended to do is to see a new technology on the horizon and do nothing but panic about it. Like, you know, Napster comes along and suddenly the music industry's like, well, this is a head scratcher. People can get free music. And of course, they prefer free music to paying for music. But at no point in the sort of 10 years that Napster reigned the seas did a music industry go, oh, we could just do this. Like, we could have our own, like, music industry Napster that was, like, you know, you paid. And it was the same deal. You got the MP3s. Instead, they went through years of crappy copy protection and shitty services that were, you know, split. Like, Windows Media. I mean, how many songs were lost when Windows Media servers shut down? It used to happen all the time. I've got music that I got from somewhere or other, you know, that I can no longer play, that I paid for, because the Windows Media server to support it no longer exists.
Yeah.
You know, years of this, and they could have just done MP3s from the start, and it took Apple to come along and go, hey, you know what, guys, enough, no more copy protection, it's stupid, it doesn't work. And people will find the music anyway. And there we go. And then after all that messing around, probably billions of dollars wasted on lawyers, on pursuing people, on just wasting money. And then they realise, oh, yeah, actually, you know, if we give people nice, easy access to music, they won't steal it anymore. And we could have told them that at the start.
It would be a wonderful, wonderful business utopia if it was as simple as all that. I do think that you know, I don't imagine there are many people in the music industry that think the way that the industry collectively handled Napster, the onset of digital music, DRM, and all these sorts of things, I don't believe any of them genuinely think that it was handled well. It probably could have been handled worse, not much worse, but it could have been handled worse, or they could have stemmed the flow.
I'm trying to think how. Are they going to shot all the artists to protect the revenue? Or are we going to shoot them all?
Saying no to Apple at all. Trying to do it themselves. The one thing that what Apple did is that it at least unified the labels under this umbrella, this umbrella, and not, you know, they could have tried to set up their own and just tried to make you buy direct from each individual label. And
well, that wouldn't necessarily have been a bad thing. I mean, I can understand why, you know, the centralized model of Apple is very nice.
It wouldn't have had this social and economic clout that doing it under the brand of Apple all in one place where it suddenly makes sense to people and to businesses. I don't think it would have had the same impact if they'd have gone it on their own.
Mm. No, I mean, of course, I do agree with you.
The fact is that the news that we're actually discussing is that a law enacted late, but ultimately out of the speaking of common public sense, has now been hamstrung by a ridiculous move that only exists to protect the job of lawyers, from what I can tell, and not musicians, and not labels, and certainly not the people who need it most, who are the people who aren't already benefiting from their music being known, but those who are desperately trying. Because I bet you anything, they are not seeing this article and thinking, good move, that. That's going to help me get noticed and be the next Taylor Swift. Brilliant. Anyway, let us know your opinions. podcast@natelangson.com. We haven't had many things, emails, that's the word I'm looking for a couple of weeks, because we haven't asked for any. And we've been doing features instead of news. So now's the time to send those emails and get them in. podcast@natelangson.com. Well, we will be back with Mr. Ian Morris in about 10 minutes' time, where we're going to talk about 3D cinema and whether or not it's a scam. Apparently, we're on a little bit of a tirade today against anti-consumer practices in the creative industries. That wasn't the intention, but it is the result. Make of that what you will. But before we get to that, we are going to take another roller coaster ride. This one, quite literally, through the roller coaster design and building process. Where are roller coasters going? I met up, via Skype that is, with a gentleman called Marco Bigotti. Now, Marco is a roller coaster engineer, and in some form, he has worked for close to 3 decades on developing roller coasters for theme parks around the world. A native Italian, it was too good an opportunity to miss when I heard Marco was visiting the UK for a conference being held, where else, but Alton Towers. I wanted to find out what makes a good roller coaster in 2015. What kinds of technology are affecting European roller coaster design, or theme park designs for that matter? And how are new designs being commissioned, being built, and being tested? So I started by asking Marco just that. How does a park go from having space for a new coaster to having one ready to ride?
I work for many people around the world, so the approach of Alton Tower is completely different from the approach of the people that come from, for example, Saudi Arabia. So the culture is completely different, but mainly they provide to me the area where they want to install the roller coaster. For Alton company like Alton Tower, normally they have a land with hill or with tree or different kind of natural constraint. And in normally in area like Middle East, they live in the shopping mall. So I receive a plan of the shopping mall where they want to install the ride. So I provide to them the first idea, the first 3D model, and sometimes for big group, I provide also the first simulation of the ride, so they can see how the ride can work inside their environment. So this is the first step.
So what makes a good roller coaster? Better still, how could a theme park in the UK lay claim to having the best roller coaster?
The best roller coaster is a roller coaster that is able to pick or catch what is the emotion of the people in that area. So if I want a family roller coaster, what I need to provide is a roller coaster very smooth with speed, but not so high acceleration, because my target is family, father, mother, and child. Or on the opposite, if the client wants a really strong roller coaster, I need to provide very fast, high acceleration, emotion, thrill, etc. So there isn't a real one coaster.
Okay, no one roller coaster can be objectively considered best. But what technology has been changing to allow new, exciting ideas to become reality within theme parks?
I believe that the big step was done more or less 10 years ago, when we passed from the gravity roller coaster, so the train go to the top of the hill, and from that point it ran till the end by gravity, and the big jump was made by using linear induction motor. So the car are accelerated by a sort of electrical motor, and this kind of motor comes from US Navy. Maybe one of the way never discovered is to use some kind of interaction between people and rides. I have seen some study related to virtual reality. So use some kind of helmet and use real emotion in new world. Or, for example, try to have some kind of gun and the people can shoot during the trip.
Wait, hang on. Guns? He meant laser guns, right?
Yeah, right.
Ah, good.
Is better the laser gun, because it's in the reality, and so you can shoot with other people that are on ground and so interact with these guys.
Are we really ready for interactive roller coaster experiences in the UK?
Starting from 30 years ago, they have seen all kind of roller coaster. So generally, they need to see something really impressive.
What about in other parts of the world?
The culture in Saudi Arabia, for example, is completely different. They start from zero. They start from only park inside a shopping mall. So huge ride must to become small ride, quite impressive ride, but in the shopping mall is quite different, and the culture is different. So I need to understand what is the public at the end. So anyway, it's different. Anyway, it's different because it's different, the culture of the people and what they expect.
We're talking roller coasters and guns. Sounds super safe. In the UK, we are well known for having rather strict health and safety rules as a nation. For example, in one roundup of questionable exploitations made by regulatory powers, Dodgem cars were proposed to be banned from bumping into each other at Butlins holiday parks. And a school in the northwest of England has banned leather footballs. Now, don't worry, parents. The primary school in question would permit the playing of football, but only if the balls were made from sponge. Now, in a world of 250 km/h roller coasters and maybe laser guns, how do designers like Marco, working for theme parks in so many countries, maintain a high level of safety in their products?
There is many different levels. First level is related to the people, safe people. I mean, when they run on the roller coaster, must be feel safe, and the acceleration must be inside the European norms. And so I need to, during the design, I need to check all kind of acceleration on the body. Second one is during the design feel, we need all my team and the team with I work with make a risk assessment related to all kind of possibility of some problem, some default of the ride. So normally what we do is design plus risk assessment on the ride. At the end, when the ride is being built or installed, there is another risk assessment on the installed ride in a way that we are sure that we have taken into account any kind of possibility of mistake or problem that can happen. Also, normally there is some inspection body that we use that help us to avoid other kind of misunderstanding problem. I have to send it, so I must be sure that when the ride or all the other design some ride, my son is safe.
Unlike what I recently learned from watching Jurassic World, where bigger, scarier dinosaurs with more teeth were essential for future business, I was learning from Marco that a good new roller coaster does not fundamentally need to be larger, faster, or dye your trousers one of many exciting shades of brown. They need to know their audience and provide a range of carefully tailored experiences.
I believe that there is, in every park, it must be a mix between huge, impressive, and thrilling rides, and family and really suitable for everyone ride. For example, some parks in Italy or Europe, they are started with roller coaster rides for all the people or public. So I mean for the family. Also today, they are coming back again to think about family, interactive ride, simulator, other kind of entertainment. Because when I go to amusement park, I need to see everything, not only the extreme ride. So I believe that is very important to have a good design, good master plan designer, able to mix all the information regarding the people.
I was coming to the end of my time with Marco, and I had one final question I wanted to draw from him. I knew I wasn't going to get the answer easily based on the conversation thus far. In fact, when I asked him what he thinks is the best roller coaster in the world, he asked me,
what is the best car in the world?
What is the best car in the world? I quickly thought back to a recent episode of Top Gear I was watching in bed and picked the McLaren P1. I should probably have plumped for a Ferrari.
McLaren P1, so you have an idea, your idea. But anyway, there isn't a real best car. From my personal point of view, the beautiful roller coaster that I've run, it was the Incredible Hulk in Universal Orlando. It's in Universal Orlando. It's a really beautiful roller coaster in the really beautiful park. And I tell you why. I personally like roller coaster, but not really extreme, because at the end of the lap, when I arrive, if the roller coaster is too extreme, I don't feel the pleasure of a good ride. The Incredible Hulk is 1 kilometer long. The car is launched in a really strange way because it's launched on the top of the hill, so you don't feel you are in the tunnel when you go on the top of the hill, but you are pushed really fast in the middle of the track without a really high acceleration, and you have a really long, beautiful track all around this lake, all around this really incredible amusement park. I want to enjoy at the end. What I want to tell you is at the end of the lap, I want to enjoy, not to be shaken from one side to the other side.
That was Marco Bigotti, owner of Ride Tech Engineering, speaking to me from the ANSYS Convergence Conference at Alton Towers. Not everyone in the world is as beautiful as you, dear listener, and not everyone knows how to download a podcast. That's why I'm encouraging you to bring someone you know into the podcasting world by telling them about this show and which app you use to listen to it. You'll be helping not only me in text message, but all podcasters who often need word of mouth more than money to help promote their work. Thanks for listening, and hopefully, thanks for the review and the help spreading the word. Or if you want to be on the show, send your comments about this episode or any other tech topic, podcast@natelangson.com. Well, it's time to put some bait on my hook, wiggle it around in some water, and what's this? Yes, I've caught myself and Ian Morris, dragging him back onto the beach. Ian, thanks for sticking with me.
Like a whale stuffed onto the beach, unable to escape.
A beached whale flipping side to side in a fury about the state of the modern creative industry. Well, flap away, sir, for the next 5 minutes, because we've got one more topic to talk about. And this stems from a problem I had the other day. Here's the problem. I wanted to see Jurassic World. It's a real problem, because it costs 16 quid per ticket to go and see a film at my nearby cinema here in London. £16. You can almost have someone killed for that, I've heard. So my company sent around an email last week saying that we had some perk system that got us 50-something percent off cinema tickets. And I thought, opportunity. It's only going to cost me about 8 quid a ticket to go and see Jurassic World. This is an opportunity I cannot pass up. It is not to be sneezed at, 50% cinema tickets. So I bought 3 for my girlfriend Kate and my brother, and off we went. And I bought the 3D one, incidentally. This is key. I bought the 3D one because the ticket to see 3D should have been a couple of quid more than the 2D version, and I thought, well, with a 55% discount, that's less than a pound to see it in 3D. Curiosity's at least worth 95 pence, you know. So I thought, fine, I'll pay the little bit extra for the 3D version. I'll go and see what 3D is looking like in cinema today. I haven't seen a 3D film since Avatar. Turns out the 3D is quite good. Like, it didn't take anything away from the film, so that's already a plus. And it did add an interesting extra dimension. Didn't really push forward storytelling in any way, but it was visually quite nice, so fair dues. But the problem occurred before I got into the cinema, because I walked in and I got into the area where the films are shown with the big television at the front of the room, and realized that being in 3D, I needed some glasses. Why do we not have any glasses? There weren't any glasses around. Obviously, there wasn't any staff to ask because it was in a dark room. So I went back out to the foyer, to where they sell the overpriced hot dogs and things, and asked somebody how I watch in 3D. And they said, I have to pay for the glasses extra. And I said, don't I pay extra for that by paying more to see the film in the first place in 3D? And she said, no, you have to pay for the glasses extra. So it's an extra quid per ticket. The film is the same. It's the same film, and it already costs more. I mean, in my head, I assumed paying more to see it in 3D would at least mean you got the tool you need to see the damn film in 3D. Otherwise, it felt to me like going into a restaurant, ordering a dinner, and then being charged 50 pence each for a knife and a fork, or 2p for some salt, or a pound of flush. I mean, it just came across to me as a giant scam.
Well, I mean, ridiculous. Should we break it down? I mean, I know that there's a lot of expenses that go along with the change to being able to project 3D. But one has to sort of question whether or not those expenses are still going on. I mean, don't forget, you know, when they switched over to 3D projection, that did often require a new projector and a new screen.
No problem. Don't have a problem with paying more.
Sure.
I genuinely don't. The ticket cost more.
Yeah.
And I am happy with that, because I agree. It is expensive. They're running twice the number of films in that sense, because they're projecting the same film in two areas. I agree. I don't mind that it costs a little bit extra.
Okay. But then we've got to break down the fact that you were paying a pound for some glasses. Now, that is objectionable, and I'll tell you why. Because they only cost 10p to make, if that. So that is really, I mean, it is just atrocious, really, isn't it? It is a scam.
It is. So I was sitting there in my seat, furious, you know, watching 30 minutes of ads, hearing it. There was a child not far away playing Lady Gaga out of its headphones. Ridiculous. But so I tweeted at the cinema in question. I don't want to name and shame because I believe this is fairly standard practice.
It
so
is.
I'm removing the cinema name out of the equation here because there's nothing fundamentally worse about this cinema than any other, I'm sure. I asked, why do I have to pay for 3D glasses when already paying more to see a 3D film, which is the same film as it is in 2D? Their answer, very quickly, in fact, and very politely over three tweets, was, "Hi, Nate, customers started paying for 3D glasses a few months ago. This was introduced so that we could reduce the cost in 3D performances and allow customers to save each visit by allowing them to purchase glasses once and use them again in future. However, 3D will always be slightly more than 2D because 3D requires additional technologies." Now, here, I kind of get the logic here. I sort of get their logic that if you were buying the glasses and keeping them and coming back to a cinema and using them again, you don't have to pay the extra pound. And
yeah,
maybe not doing that means they can reduce £1 off the cinema ticket, thus better value for customers.
Yeah, but I bet they haven't. I bet the prices... When was the last time the cost of anything went down? Like, you go to the cinema and one week it's £10 and the next week it's £11. But I bet you've never been to the cinema and one week it was £11 and the next it was £10. Nothing ever goes down. So that's just a scam, isn't it? They're saying one thing, and actually that's not true.
I'm slightly concerned that I've managed to turn the tables on myself here, and I seem to be the one defending. And I was sort of anticipating you would be the advocate of Mr. Devil and coming out in favour of what they did. But
I mean, I probably could do if you really wanted me to. But
nah,
I mean,
it's less fun.
I see it as much of a scam as you do. It 3D is rubbish. Like, I mean, I can see. Were there 2D screenings available?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some films in the past, like I believe that the Judge Dredd film, actually they didn't show it in 2D, which apparently is a lot of the reason that it didn't do very well cinematically. It's an absolutely fantastic film, but they wanted to force people to go and see it in 3D. And I mean, no one wants to be forced to see anything in any format, do they?
Certainly not.
You wouldn't want to be forced to. Well, you wouldn't want to be forced to see a film in IMAX if you weren't interested, would you? I mean, IMAX is quite an intimidating process.
I understand IMAX don't charge you for the glasses. Somebody on Twitter, I had many replies, probably 24 replies to this tweet that I made about, well, several tweets that I made in rage about all this while I was waiting for the damn film to start. And apparently, IMAX don't charge for the glasses.
Yeah, but you are paying quite a lot more for an IMAX presentation, I think.
I think that the issue is that as somebody who took a chance on cinema, like I almost gave them the benefit of the doubt on the day that I had a discount on the ticket. So, and again, it's not because I don't feel I can afford the full price. It's just that I'm indignant as a consumer to be charged it because I don't feel the experience is worth £16 per person to see those films in those cinemas. Some of the Everyman cinemas are lovely. The smaller independent ones, they don't get the same size screens or the same films, but they're very lovely. And that is an experience I don't mind paying extra for, but I don't want to pay £16 to sit next to a stain. You know, I had to pick between two stained seats and, you know, one of them was a brown stain and one of them was a white stain. Neither of them were appealing stains is the problem.
No, it sounds horrible.
And to be charged £1 extra, I felt scammed and I felt the other word that I was thinking of, just tricked.
Exploited.
By the whole thing. Yeah. So I wanted to put it into the show because I wanted to hear your feedback and I wanted to hear listener feedback as well because I can sort of see this from two angles, and I'm not 100% which side of this fence I sit on. Because on their argument, their PR, who replied to this tweet, you know, did their job very well. They gave me a reason that I can technically believe. The problem is that it wasn't quite strong enough to suppress the feeling of being cheated, and I just didn't like having paid money to go and sit and feel, put me basically in a bad mood for half an hour doing this. It just felt...
Well,
it felt wrong.
Here's the solution then. Why don't they offer people the opportunity to either buy the glasses and keep them for future screenings if they're regular 3D viewers? And if not, why can't we just borrow a pair? Like, you know, I don't know, give them a quid deposit and then you get the quid back when you drop the glasses off. That really essentially is all they need, isn't it? That would keep you happy. I mean, given that people seem prepared to pay a little bit extra for a 3D presentation, then it stands to reason that, you know, you could probably get them to just give a quid and then get it back. And then perhaps some people won't give a quid or you know, perhaps won't want their quid back, and they'll go. I know it's a small amount of money in comparison with the £16 you've already spent, or the £8 in your case, but, you know, I mean, like you say, it's the straw that broke the camel's back, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very weak camel.
And also, I still think their argument about it, you know, costing more to project a 3D film might have been true when they put the equipment in. And they may still be paying for the equipment, who knows? Yeah. But 3D is not the only thing that benefits from that equipment. Like, the move to digital cinema was a huge one, and actually will stand to, you know, save them a lot of money, because it is extremely expensive and difficult to move film reels around, which they no longer have to do. And what also that means is that they no longer have to employ projectionists, which is a terrible thing. And if you listen to Mark Kermode, he'll explain in detail why. But what you get now is someone lines up the projector, they check it at the start of the day probably, and then one person probably runs every screen in that theatre, in that, you know, complex. So they've saved themselves a massive amount of money from moving from film projection to digital. So they can eat it, basically. They're just full of it. They can say that they've invested in equipment, but ultimately they had to invest in that equipment to keep going, you know, to keep, you know, to cut their costs and to bring film into the modern era, because you need digital projection to do a lot of stuff, and that's going to be increasingly true. Mm.
Well, it's been really interesting to talk about it. It's not felt like the most balanced discussion, because we both seem to agree here, but I feel that there must be a better solution here. Like, I don't feel that the way this is going could be sustainable, because the ticket prices are getting so extortionately expensive that even though I quite like to see more films, I feel indignant at the cost of having to go somewhere and pay that to see that film, and I get the bonus of feeling cheated once I give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't like that. I would like to see more films. Why are they doing this to me, Ian? So bad. So
I don't know, Nate.
Let us
get a projector at home. Just do it yourself. It's a lot better.
Let us know your thoughts, podcast@natelangson.com. We will, of course, read any emails that we get on this topic. podcast@natelangson.com. That will do for this week. Mr. Ian Morris, been a pleasure, sir.
Smashing. Same.
And don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. We have 60 reviews on there at the moment. It's fantastic. We're still 5 stars. We hit, the other day, number 80 in the entire iTunes chart. That's not just on in technology. That is the 80th most popular podcast in the world on iTunes.
That is pretty amazing.
That is an amazing achievement. I'm incredibly happy, and I'm very grateful to everybody who leaves us reviews and tells people about the show. So thank you to everybody. Please keep reviews coming in and emails to podcast@natelangson.com, and Ian and I will undoubtedly be complaining about something in 1 week.